Russian women from a punk rock band backed by celebrities like Sir Paul McCartney and Madonna have been jailed for 2 years. They protested in a Moscow cathedral against President Putin and reacted with giggles when the judge issued the sentences. Police are investigating whether Ian Brady wrote a letter revealing where one of his victims is buried. His mental health advocate claims the Moors murderer gave her a sealed envelope to pass on to Keith Bennett's mother when he dies. Jackie Powell was arrested and bailed yesterday. Paddy Wivel, who was shooting a documentary about the Moors murders, says Ms. Powell told him about the letter in their interview.
I didn't see that envelope, but Jackie told me about it. She paraphrased, but she said that he didn't want to take secrets to his grave and he wanted Winnie Johnson to be able to rest.
A 13-year-old boy has been arrested on suspicion of attempted murder following an attack which left a man fighting for his life. The 46-year-old victim was kicked, punched and left in a critical condition with serious head injuries after the attack in Eastbourne last night. Ecuador's National Assembly has passed a resolution condemning Britain for what it says are threats to raid its London embassy. Yesterday, the country granted political asylum to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. To football, and Robin van Persie insists that no one at Arsenal's angry with him as he's completed his transfer to Manchester United. He had a year left on his contract with the Gunners. Manager Sir Alex Ferguson says Arsenal counterpart Arsene Wenger drove a hard bargain.
Arsene knew that the boy wanted to leave, and they then knew they wanted to join us, so it made it a bit easier. But it didn't make it easy in terms of trying to reduce the fee. He could run a poker school and govern him.
And production on Iron Man 3 is on hold after star Robert Downey Jr. hurt his ankle during filming. Marvel Studios says the actor was injured whilst performing a stunt in North Carolina. It's set to be released next spring. That's the latest. I'm Christian Yeo.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for St George West and former Lord Mayor Chris Davis. Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance is here too. In the second hour after six, the Private Finance Initiative, or PFI, might seem like the answer to our dreams, with a government strapped for cash that enables public bodies to build the things they can't afford and pay for them over a decade or so. But how much more does it cost? And where are the finance directors and trustees that signed the PFI deals when things go wrong? And why has one London NHS trust that went down the PFI route gone bankrupt? Plus, US-owned First Group, who promoted passenger revolts here on the Paddington service PIP Virgin Trains and PIP Virgin Trains to the Post, with Richard Branson saying the system's unfair. BCFM's Steve Satan pops in, and he's a national spokesperson for Rail Futures. And last but not least, the lady who took it on the landmines industry and lost. Well, we've all been waiting for an easy-to-read definitive book on the Diana assassination. Well, 160 pages, it's arrived, and it's called The Paris-London Connection, out this week. But like the evidence of this establishment cover-up, reported virtually nowhere in the British mainstream press. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 and some light rain. This weekend, highs up to 25 degrees Celsius, pumping up the temperatures. Feeling muggy though, some hazy sunshine and some showers on Saturday, less so on Sunday. Highs of 23 next week, feeling cooler as the week progresses, some sunny spells and plenty of showers. Next weekend, that's the 25th and 26th of August, highs of 20 Celsius, sunny spells and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guest then, and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for St George West and former Lord Mayor, whose car died on the way here 2 weeks ago today, hopefully equipped with a new car, Chris Davis. Hi Chris, welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you, Tony, for inviting me.
Now, first of all, don't you get a car on the city?
Well, first of all, I'm not the councillor for St George South West. I'm the councillor for Knoll Ward.
Noel Ward. Okay, first of all, let's get our facts straight then. So for Noel Ward, yeah. Okay, thanks. Now, what about, on the City Council as a councillor? I mean, you were chatting just now saying that we've got six-figure sums for the boss of the university. What remuneration do you get? Because we've all voted you in to do this job. You had a car. It broke down 2 weeks ago. It sounds terrible. I mean, surely they can get a car for you, the City.
Now look, I've got another car. I didn't say it's a brand new car. It's a car that's got a few miles on the clock, but I'm pleased I've got something fairly new. The City Council, I think everyone knows what a councillor starts on. I think it's been very static since I've been made a councillor in 2003. It's about £11,000 a year. And if you become an executive member, then obviously you get an SRA, added responsibility. I've never been in that position, but I've been very happy to fulfil the role of councillor for Noel Ward since 2003.
Okay, so how much, if you were to be promoted, how much do the cabinet get as an annual payment?
I think... I'm not too sure, actually. I haven't checked on that. Something I haven't looked into, but there is a certain amount they get paid extra for doing that role. It's more or less full time, and in fact, I think most of my time is taken up as a councillor full time. I'm very fortunate to have retired, so I can fulfil that role quite
okay. So you've got a fair amount of time. Well, tell us about yourself. What got you originally into politics?
I think when I retired from the police in 2000. For a few years, I had different jobs. I retrained as a registrar. I went to the prison service and also also the court service as well. But in 2003, I started to get interested in politics, and I could never do that before in the police. But and also at that time, in about 2000, I got very interested in running the community centre, Redcatch Community Centre in Knowle. And that, I thought that was very, very fulfilling. It affected a lot of people. It's gone from strength to strength since that period. And then I realised that we did have councillors. We all know we've got councillors. I'm not saying they're particularly good or particularly bad, but I thought I could do a better job. There was an election. I got interested in one political party. I don't know if I ought to mention that. You've already said I'm a Liberal Democrat. That's the party that's...
Okay, so why did you... What was it about the Liberal Democrats that floated your boat? You know, why them and not one of the other parties?
I read the manifesto, and that convinced me that that was the party for me.
So what was in there? What was it that made you think, wow, these are the people, you know... Was it absolutely... You can't have been everything, surely.
I always make a comparison with what was being done at that time. Politics do change, and... I felt that the Liberal Democrats had a better grasp of what they wanted to do in this city. I think a lot of people think you're going to be acting as an MP. It gets very confused, those two roles between a city councillor and an MP. And there are only so many things you can do as a councillor. And you go on to ask. We've only got one Liberal Democrat MP in Bristol, and he fulfills a different role to mine. But my role, I don't know, it's a lot of different things. Unless you get into it, I should be doing a party political thing, and I haven't come on this programme to do that.
Okay, what about committees? What committees do you sit on? Because that's one of the important jobs of the councillor, is to make decisions on those committees, isn't it?
Since 2003, I've been almost on every committee. I've done all this.
Okay, so what are you on at the moment then?
Licensing, public safety and protection, which deals with a lot of... taxes and etc., public rights of way, and planning or development control. There are quite a few others as well, but they're the main commissions. There are three commissions. I know when we inherited the licensing from the magistrates, that was a central government decision to switch decisions made by councillors rather than magistrates. Although, you know, when we make a decision on anything that comes before us, those that either have to be fined or whatever, they have a right to go to a magistrate afterwards to put their case. But that was interesting. It was done in a very short period under the previous government, and I think it's over about 3 or 4 months. I know it's very, very hard time to get it all ironed out, and you're well on top of what you were doing there. But there are only so many of us on there. Councillor Ron Stone was the chair, and I believe he's still the chair. And he was the chair of the licensing and still is.
Now, one of the interesting ones you mentioned there is development control. This is always a bit of a bone for contention. Well, we've got the two stadia, which certainly the local people don't really want a big development in what is essentially greenfield sites at the moment. And then, of course, the other thing is we've had a discussion on this show over the last 3 or 4 weeks over the amount of empty office space. I mean, I realise you're not the developer; you can't decide who wants to build where, but why is it, do you think, that we're seeing even now massive new office blocks which many of these businesses are moving into, but we've got a lot of empty offices in the city, Chris, and we've also got quite a lot of unemployed people who would love to be working in those offices if only the rents weren't so high.
I agree on everything you say. I've been on the development control or planning, so everybody understands what that is, since 2003. I have come off it last year, and I came off it for 2 years when I was Lord Mayor. I don't think I came off most committees doing that role as well. Planning is you have to know what you're doing on planning, and it does take a lot of training to do that. You just don't make decisions ad hoc.
You get advice from the planning officers, don't you, from the officers of the City Council?
Training, and I've been on all the training courses, as I have been with Public Rights Away and all the others. It's quite a long, and licensing as well, and it's quite a lot to get into your head. But to go back to what you're saying about planning, I think things are moving forward. I know you mentioned the stadium. It was one of the first, of course, it's on public rights of way that came into the Greens issue. And when I finished doing the Lord Mayor, the first committee they put me on was public rights of way. So the first thing that came before us was the permissions, or rather the green area. You're referring to Ashton Gate, are you? Well, there are three options there. There was a green space. There's also an area for the stadium, and also another area in the centre for the community. It goes, and I think a decision was made then that we should go down that route because it seems the most sensible. So everyone in the community got what they wanted, and also the stadium. But as you know, it's gone backwards and forwards, and I've listened with interest. I'm not on the planning now, but I'm still on public rights of way, so I wait with interest to see what happens there.
Okay, we're also joined by Robin Clapp from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Tony.
Now, we've got this mayoral election coming up soon, and I'll be asking Chris about this too when you finish, but how do the various mayoral candidates square up as regards the cuts?
Well, I think there is one candidate who has overtly said he opposes the cuts, and that's the Respect candidate. I think we can assume that there may be one or two others who throw their hats into the ring over the next couple of weeks, but the three main parties are all continuing to sign up to the austerity agenda.
But I mean, isn't there an air of unreality to that? Because where are they going to get this money from? I mean, this is money that comes from central government and from local taxation. You can't spend money that's not there if you want to stop the cuts.
Well, I think we dealt with this last week, Tony. There are billions and billions of pounds that are not able to be obtained from the government because those monies are hiding away in tax havens. There are £750 billion worth of assets in the banks belonging to big companies that can't see a way of investing that money productively. And so the argument that there isn't any money in this country is false. I think what we have is a lot of money. The trouble is it's not being put to productive use, and consequently we have an economy that is going through a double dip recession. So I would like to see all the mayoral candidates taking the stand that what we need to get Bristol back to work is to start demanding from central government that the money be made available to produce jobs, to produce hope, to produce dignity, and to produce futures for young people, but for all those other people who are suffering the stigma of being without work at this stage because there are no jobs. And so You know, I wait with bated breath. I don't expect the coalition parties to subscribe to this agenda. It's a great shame that the Labour Party too, even though it isn't in control in Bristol, has effectively gagged itself and won't actually talk about putting forward a real alternative to this austerity nonsense that we've had from central government since
2010. Well, they're worried about the swing voters. But, I mean, we're in a situation where there's more people, you know, having trouble finding work. There was probably the biggest problem is the household budgets. You know, as people's rents go up and as people's outgoings, you know, things like utility bills, this kind of thing is going up. I mean, it seems that we're trying to survive on less and less disposable income. Now, we're relying on each other more, but maybe trusting each other less. You know, there's this sort of slightly sort of dog-eat-dog attitude out there coming in.
Well, I think the problem is that if you continually cut demand in the economy by holding down wages, by putting public sector workers through pay freezes, by introducing pay freezes into private sector firms, then what you do is make it less likely that people who have the disposable income to go out and buy, which in turn means that businesses won't invest to produce. And of course, small businesses in particular, as we've discussed in the past, are still being strangled by the big banks' refusal to release capital to allow them to borrow. So a GCSE student would be able to work out that it's not common sense to proceed with this mad austerity policy at a time when the biggest problem facing Britain is not inflation, but actually the very real likelihood of a recession that could last for years and years. It's being called by many economists now the Great Recession. And I note with interest, Tony, that of the 20 economists who in 2010 came out and endorsed George Osborne and Danny Alexander's policies, nine of them yesterday released a letter in which they said that these austerity policies have now turned into an extremely dangerous situation for the government and, more importantly, the people of this country, that of creating the conditions for a depression. So it's time to change course.
Okay, let's just bring in Chris Davis here from Noel Ward. I got it right that time, Chris. What are your thoughts about the general economic picture? Because we don't really like to think of Bristol as being, you know, just simply at the mercy of the policies of Westminster. What are your thoughts about what is going on economically in the city? Because we are facing some really serious cuts at the moment, aren't we?
Well, you were talking about the planning earlier on, and I'm looking around now. I think there's one site. I'm only using this as an example. There's only one site at Ratcliffe Wharf, which I think we're all familiar with in Bristol, and that's being gone ahead with, and plans are happening at this moment. I'm going to say that for maybe the last 30 years, I remember it was an old city council builder's yard, and now we've got plans, or there are plans, to go ahead and do that. And also other areas around the old brewery at Old George's. Say, I look at things, projects like that, and I do wonder when they say we haven't got enough money. You continue down to areas around Temple Meads and the plans and the demolition they've got going on there.
Well, what about the building? This is the trouble. You go down Temple Way, you know, you can see that the old clerical medical building and the one opposite. This is all just flat rubble. I'm waiting to see is the scaffolding going up new buildings.
I think we're forgetting the past, and I don't want to harp on at what we had in the back. Why are we in this position with austerity? That's the question you want to ask. Because we've more or less had the country bankrupt with the previous government.
Well, they bailed out the banks, didn't they? Whose fault is this? I mean, this is one of the things we're always tossing backwards and forwards here. Is it the banks' fault?
Really
is it the Labour government's fault for bailing them out?
I knew you would ask that anyway, but my feelings are that I heard a figure of £69 million pounds a day interest that this government has to pay back. Now, we're never going to get ourselves out of this mess. I'm going to be optimistic. You were saying the austerity. That is the reason why we're in this mess. Just to ignore it and just grumble about, we must have cuts. Yes, we have to have cuts and pull in our belt. That's the only way you're going to survive. But to just throw, the money's not there to do that. But yes, go back to Bristol. I'm optimistic about all the projects and all the great things we're doing in this city. very pleased with what we're doing here. Let's see, I can go on about other areas that I know will have a great effect on the community further just down the road from where I am at Temple Meads. I know there's some big plans there for the large project they got there. They're developing the bordering buildings from the Temple Meads itself. It's all good news.
Robin.
Well, I think it's interesting that even Danny Alexander, one of Chris's parliamentary colleagues, who has been very zealous in echoing George Osborne's comments over the last couple of years, has this week come out and suggested that the be-all and end-all is not examining the credit rating of the British economy and that there may be a case for more investment. Now, he clearly isn't saying there should be a plan B. That would be too much of a climb back down. But we have a situation where, let's be honest, the banks for 25 or 30 years were allowed to run roughshod over the rest of the economy. The situation that occurred in 2008-2009 created a panic within government internationally. The banks were bailed out. One of the reasons why the deficit rose, and neither the Conservatives nor the Liberal Democrats ever talk about this, is because the then Labour government was forced to take enormous dollops of public money and bail out the banks, some of which are still years away from being lucrative banks that can be resold to the private sector. I would personally say they should remain in public hands and should be properly taken over into public ownership. We have an absurd situation in this country where what you have is a government that claims there is no money, yet is using the so-called deficit to carry through an ideological attack on the public sector. And Bristol City Council is at the forefront of this, sadly, with the decision to privatise and close the care homes, the daycare centres. I've been talking to people in some of those care homes, including a 96-year-old woman who was promised she would end her days in that home, and she's one of those who's now being told she's got to lose the home. So we have to ask the question, if things are so optimistic in Bristol, why is the council degrading itself in the eyes of Bristolians by forcibly moving elderly people from council-run care homes, which have had a great endorsement from the relatives of those people, into the private sector? And the answer is, Tony, because the private sector won't invest unless the government gives them the
okay,
money.
OK, well, let's ask Chris to answer it rather than you answer it. That is a difficult one, isn't it, Chris? Because you're saying, we've got to sort this out. There's going to be pain. Why do we have to endure the pain? Why not just pay the interest on the debt and carry on?
I can speak from experience of going around some of these care homes. And basically, a lot of them are not fit for purpose. They've got toilets were used by a whole group of different people. There's no en suites. I've been around many of them as Lord Mayor, and I wasn't very pleased with what I saw there. I think what John Rogers is doing is the right step to take. He's made alternative arrangements for all these people. The picture you're painting is that they're all going to be kicked out. Well, that is not the case, and I'm strongly in support of John and all he's doing. He knows the situation with the homes. He's been around them as I have, and I haven't been very impressed with all these homes. And people deserve a lot better, and they're going to get better too.
But one of the other things is the elderly people are going to start to have to pay for their care, aren't they? In fact, many of them may lose their homes as they get into the care system.
Not necessarily.
They will. Yeah, I mean, some certainly will. They'll be forced to mortgage their homes basically to pay for their care. If they're quite wealthy with their own property, then they will not get state aid. They will have to use a mortgage on their home. They'll have to slowly sell it in order to pay for their care.
Not necessarily. They don't have to sell their homes at all. They can still continue as they are, and they can still get all the benefits that the City Council can offer them. There's no reason why they need to sell their homes.
Okay, Robin?
Well, that's contrary to what's written in black and white in the latest government paper, which perhaps Chris hasn't read. But the thing is, I completely agree with Chris. We want good quality homes for our elderly in Bristol. But why does that mean privatisation? That's the question Chris didn't answer. We've just had scandals up the road in South Gloucestershire with the Winterbourne Castlebeck debacle. The private sector, when it takes over home care and daycare centres, will be looking to maximise their profit. There's no reason for them to invest in private care if they can't make money.
OK, Robin, we've got another story this week, which is the G4S Olympic effort shows the limits of the private sector, says Philip Hammond. Now, he's the Defence Secretary, Chris, and he's saying he's praising the military, the rescue of the Games, the mess that G4S made of the security, and he's saying lessons can be learned. He says the failure by G4S to meet the Olympic security requirements has shown the limitations of private sector companies taking on public sector contracts. So this begs the question, doesn't it? Where do we draw the line? If the Defence Secretary is saying, you know, that this was the wrong move to privatise the security at the London Olympics, and that there are places of the public sector that shouldn't be privatised, where do we draw the line?
Well, we're very, very grateful for the military to come along and police these games. Without them, I don't know what we would have done. The G4S, it's a private company, and they've employed them quite legitimately. They haven't produced the goods. They have people trained, and they weren't in the right place at the right time. And I think that's maybe the only action that Hammond can take at that late stage. Say it came upon us about a week before the games, and I was astounded to think they haven't got it all to maybe 3 weeks before the games, and I was astounded to think they haven't got their act together at that stage. But it's you're relying on private companies to do that.
I mean, someone comes along to you, don't they? They say, "Here, sign this contract. We'll deliver the goods." But at the end of the day, will they?
Well, they were in default. I presume they'll have to pay something towards the military expense of providing these soldiers.
Yes, so I imagine that one of these army officers has twisted the arm of the chief executive of G4S to get a few bob out of them. Robin, what are your thoughts about, you know, what you can and what you can't privatise?
Well, it beggars belief that the government claims it only knew a few days before the Olympics were due to start that the G4S contract was in such a shambles.
Well, this was, to be fair, about 2 weeks, 10 days before.
Yes, but if the government only found out 2 weeks before, what trust can you have in a government that claims it knows how to run the economy? It's a nonsense. And privatisation will always throw up examples of this kind, because the raison d'etre, the reason why these private firms bid for these contracts, is firstly because they believe they can put in a competitive tender, which usually means trying to undercut their rivals, and that in turn means squeezing wages and squeezing conditions. And secondly, this firm really should have been faced with, as a part of that contract, a 100% penalty clause, which meant if they didn't deliver, they didn't get a penny. If I offer to do something and don't deliver, I don't expect to get a big payoff, yet G4S is still going to get a big payoff. Care should not be privatised in this city. That's a very clear message we should be taking to the council on the 18th of September when it meets to discuss this again. It's absurd to close care homes and privatise them. Let the council do up the care homes with public money.
Well, the council obviously decided that they can do the care homes for less money. That's one of the points of it, and actually maybe even do them up. But we've got another announcement this week, which has not really made the national headlines, but it's quite an interesting one nevertheless. London Metropolitan University could be the UK's first privatised university. Profit-making company poised to run university in first for the UK. This is David Henke at xronews.com. He says that current management appears to be hell-bent, that's one of the union people saying that, on deeply damaging our university's reputation, as plans for privatisation of London Metropolitan University may roll out right across other English universities. Now, Chris, this is certainly the first time I've come across this. Did you know that there was a possibility that some of our universities, this one being a sort of leader in the field, may be privatised?
No, I've never heard of them, actually. I was a member of the Council of Bristol University. I would think we retain our two famous universities here, the UE and obviously Bristol University. London Metropolitan, never heard of it.
But what about the principle? And I asked you before, didn't I, about what you can and what you can't privatise?
Well, I don't know the full story behind what they can offer and the premises, etc. It seems all a bit. This is only a suggestion, surely.
Yeah, well, apparently it's going out
£500 million.
This is going out to contract to run most of its services, putting those services out to tender, expecting to announce the winning bidder later this month. The contract's being, it costs, apparently, this is what it costs to run London Metropolitan University, £500 million, Robin.
Well, it's quite clear, if you privatise London Metropolitan University and you pay £500 million to be the beneficiary of that privatisation, the first thing you would do is cut jobs, cut conditions, and very probably down the line, if things don't pan out, you will face the prospect of a university closing.
But isn't this
young people halfway through a degree, where do they go?
Isn't this inevitable? Because the government, is, as Chris has explained, is running out of money. They have two choices, really. They can either privatise it or they can close the thing down.
No, it isn't. It isn't inevitable, Tony. There is an ideological issue going on here. There is an idea still pervasive in the coalition, and unfortunately echoed within New Labour's leadership, that public is bad, private is good. And if they didn't have a good lesson a few weeks ago from the G4S debacle, from the care home debacle with Castlebeck last year, then it shows that these people are not driven by what is economically rational. They're driven by propaganda and ideology. It is not going to be cheaper to run a private university if that private university at some stage goes bust. And should we not, in the 21st century anyway, be using public money to provide core services? This is the point that I would always come back to. The private sector has a whole history of showing that it will take the money and run. We need a society, particularly in areas like care of the elderly and so on, that isn't dependent on private sector. Now, Chris mentions John Rogers, and John's off to new fields now. He's the Liberal Democrat mayoral candidate. He's put someone else in place to answer all the questions. But what happens if some of these care homes are privatised in Bristol and go bankrupt? Will the Liberal Democrats at a future stage stand up and apologise to the families of residents in this city whose care home has gone bust? Because,
Robin,
will happen.
Surely that is just one of the things that comes with privatisation. If it's a private business, private businesses can go bankrupt. That's just a fact of
life.
Well,
of course it is, Tony, and that's why I oppose it.
Okay, Chris. Is there anything more you want to say on privatisation? Because we've spent quite a while on it now. But I wonder if you'd just like to sum up for us.
I must say, it's not all doom and gloom. I did go over John's efforts in that, and he will continue up until November. He's still the executive member for that department. He's doing a great job. And as I said, I can only reiterate what I went over earlier on. I have been round these care homes. They're not fit for purpose. And I think the effort that John is making in providing new homes, and there are some new homes going up, you haven't mentioned those, and I wish John was here that he could highlight those.
Well,
homes.
I'm sure he will do in future weeks. Anyway, on to our next story. The US government is secretly spying on everyone using civilian security cameras, says WikiLeaks. Mysteriously, just as this story appeared on the WikiLeaks website, they had the biggest ever denial of service attack. This is an attempt by servers around the world to send false requests to a website which render it impossible to view. A denial of service is also shortened to DDoS attack. And so as soon as this information appeared on WikiLeaks, this denial of service attack brought the site down for 10 days. There were quite a lot of people that had copies of what was on the site before it went down. And a lot of people pointing to this surveillance system. Now, anyone who takes a photograph at high-risk locations is logged as a suspected terrorist on a vast network of secret spy cameras linked to the US government, according to these leaked emails on WikiLeaks. People pointing cameras in New York are regarded as suspicious, and facial recognition images of them from the civilian CCTV will be fed into a data service run by private US firm Abraxas. Now, combining this also, Robin, with this week's story about Julian Assange, we've got three things going on here, really. all to do with WikiLeaks. One is the business at the embassy. The other is this is Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The other is his possible extradition. And then we've got this as well: the website actually being taken down when they're putting up some quite well, looks to me certainly some interesting information. This is basically investigative journalism they're doing.
Well, absolutely, Tony. I remember when I was 10 years old and went to London for the first time, I stood in the middle of Trafalgar Square with my little camera and took photographs of all the buildings around Trafalgar Square. I think if I tried that today, even as a 10-year-old, I'd probably be jumped on and seen to be a terrorist.
Well, this is in the United States, but I will point out that it does say, according to these leaked emails, that trap wire cameras, that's this system, are also in the use at 10 Downing Street, home of the British Prime Minister, according to another email from the firm behind them. Chris, what are your thoughts about this sort of big surveillance thing? And it's all run by a private company.
Well, as it's as you said here, or rather it's mentioned in your report, it's got shades of the Bourne Identity with Matt Damon. And all that he was doing in some of his CIA roles. I don't know. I know they have got, I think most people know this, if you mention a certain word, a type of explosive, then it will register.
Semtex, I think that's the one, isn't it? I think it might have just registered.
Right, it might be BOMB. That will register with them.
Yeah.
And
this is the Echelon system which picks up emails, yes. And especially if you're chit-chatting on the phone, apparently a little red light comes on somewhere, right, if you say these words.
Now, if you've got that technology, and the British government has got that technology, I'm sure the American government has got that as well. Going back to other things that Robin was mentioning about the cameras and everything, I wouldn't have thought, say, we can't get our own act together here, let alone the Americans sharing anything that we do. Looking around, I have seen all the cameras used in the Wilder House and also at the Brunel House, and they are quite, if you've ever been down there, it is quite extensive just out throughout the city of Bristol. And
But I mean, surely there's a potential for abuse here. If there's a private company, someone can come along to them and say, well, we want to buy some services from you.
The people that have got access to that is the police.
Well, that's here in Bristol, thank goodness.
Yes, so I don't know. It's not out to the private sector, and I see what you're getting at. And we're talking about government positions.
What are your thoughts about what's been going on with the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, though, in the Ecuadorian embassy? Well, I mean, for me, looking at that, I look at that situation, I think he could be there for years.
No, I don't think so. I think there was a mistake made by the foreign officer mentioning about we'll go in and get him out. That was a definite mistake. And actually, these mistakes do happen, even in central government. So that was wrong. Mr. Hague has made a statement, which I did catch, about we won't allow this...
Well, for those that didn't catch it, let's have a listen to it now, We've got a clip from William Hague's statement yesterday about Julian Assange.
We're disappointed by the statement by Ecuador's foreign minister today that Ecuador has offered political asylum to Julian Assange. The British authorities are under a binding obligation to extradite him to Sweden. The Ecuadorian government's decision this afternoon does not change that in any way. Nor does it change the current circumstances in any way. We remain committed to a diplomatic solution that allows us to carry out our obligations as a nation under the Extradition Act. It's important to understand that this is not about Mr. Assange's activities at WikiLeaks or the attitude of the United States of America. He is wanted in Sweden to answer allegations of serious sexual offences. We will remain fully committed to seeking a legal and binding solution to this with the government of Ecuador. But it is important that everyone understands that as a nation under law, believing in the rule of law, we must ensure that our laws are respected and are followed.
So, Chris, there we are. We care about the rule of law, so we've just got to follow the rule of law. Are you sure this has got nothing, this alleged offence in Sweden, to do with Julian Assange and his website WikiLeaks and their investigative journalism? Because the problem I have with this is, yes, the European arrest warrant does say he should be taken over to Sweden. But he's still not even been charged over in Sweden. I mean, you're a former policeman yourself. This is a little bit strange, isn't it? If he's not actually been charged in Sweden, why should he be taken over there for questioning? Surely detectives from Sweden can quite easily travel to the UK, can't they?
The usual procedure is to an arrest warrant back for bail or not back for bail. And I don't know if this has been sent to the Home Office or to the Met to discharge this, but usually that's the usual procedure or practice, which I would think most governments would do. I don't know what Mr. Hague is doing, actually. Maybe he should have just said, well, we have an arrest warrant from the Swedish police or Swedish government for the arrest of this man. We need to get him arrested. Maybe that's the picture that needed to be painted to the Ecuadorian consulate in London.
But I mean, someone who's dealt with these sort of criminal matters in the past, I mean, surely it's got to get up to a certain threshold over in Sweden before they will actually charge the guy and then order him to be extradited.
You know, the scant information, however, there are two females there that registered complaint that he's a sexual assault. He has to answer those. I don't quite know what Ecuadorian government are doing. Obviously, the United States has been brought into this as well, but they said the United States have denied any charges that they're pressurising Britain to siege Assange.
Well, the fear being that he may hop from, be taken from Sweden to the United States. Robin, what are your thoughts about this Assange business this week?
Well, my feeling is, if this were an ordinary case and Assange had been accused of impropriety, then he would probably have gone back to Sweden and there would be no question of seeking asylum in an embassy. But I think the record of the US government over many, many years in several continents doesn't fill one with confidence that they will stick to what they've said, i.e. not seek to have him extradited to the United States. It is very clear that the US hate Assange. He has been a major embarrassment to them through the WikiLeaks information that he's put out into the public domain. And the other thing that's very clear, once again, is William Hague doesn't know what he's talking about. You can't go into the Ecuadorian embassy with police and forcibly remove him, because if you do that, you create a situation across the world where any embassy is fair game for any regime that wants to get somebody out of it. How would that stand in a country in Central Asia, for instance, where a British citizen had taken refuge and was poured out of that embassy by a reactionary government? So it now is a stalemate, because if he comes out of the embassy, he will be arrested. The Ecuadorians can't get him in a suitcase and take him to Ecuador in a plane. And I think the fact that Hague had to backtrack so quickly shows once again what an ill-briefed man he is. He should never have made a statement as provocatively as that. But if I were Assange, I would not leave that embassy, because the next thing he'll find is he's in the Pentagon being tortured.
Well, I hate to say it, but he's actually running the country pretty much this week, isn't he, William Hague? Because Clegg and Cameron are out of the country. Now, Chris, what are your thoughts on this one then? I mean, has he made a mistake by invoking the idea that maybe diplomatic immunity may be taken over by the British?
It's a little bit strange, really, because my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Mr. Assange was invited by the Ecuadorian consulate to come into their consulate. It wasn't the other way around. Mr. Assange didn't ask for diplomatic immunity. He was invited into the embassy. That's the way I've heard it.
No, I think he walked in there. Strange. He had an interview with the Ecuadorian Prime Minister.
But they invited him in to the
president
consulate.
Even. The other thing worrying about all this is Bradley Manning. This is the guy in the United States who handed a lot of information to WikiLeaks, which they then put up, which has very much embarrassed the US government. And we're just hearing that President Obama's campaign headquarters in the United States has just been taken over by nearly 100 pro-Bradley Manning protesters who are complaining about the appalling conditions he's being kept in, the harsh conditions forced on Bradley Manning in military detention in the United States. So, you know, this whole business, where does it leave investigative journalism, Robin?
In a very dangerous place. I think if you make any comment these days that upsets the Pentagon or upsets London,
then a way will be found to deem you a danger to the state, and you can well therefore find yourself in a position that Assange, Bradley Manning, and a number of others, I have to say, have found themselves in. I think courageous journalism is being attacked by those who would want to maintain the secret world.
But the Pentagon will say, look, this guy has just taken information, secret information, and handed it on to a publisher to put online. This is a violation of national security in the US.
Well, yes, the Pentagon will say that, but there's a great counter-argument, which is that much of that information deserves to be in the public domain. If you look at the American state, it is one of the most secretive states in the world, and the heroes and heroines who are standing up for freedom, who are actually standing up for the values that the US was built on when it was founded as a state, are now being persecuted for wanting to bring the truth into the public domain. The day that journalists feel so intimidated that they stop reporting controversy because they think they're going to be threatened with arrest, deportation or whatever, would be not only a very sad day for journalism, it will show that the dark night has come.
Okay, on to our next story. Bristol could end up with only one accident and emergency. This is in the Evening Post this week. The Post. I must keep calling it that. Bristol could end up with just one accident and emergency department as part of plans to rearrange health services across the city. The Post understands there have been discussions about the possibility of one of Bristol's A&E departments closing as part of wider discussions over the possible merger of Bristol's two large hospital trusts. That's into one billion annual turnover trust. The new hospital being built at Southmead would be the most likely site for a single accident and emergency. That would mean no accident and emergency in the city centre, Chris.
Well, I think that will still continue. We must have one in the city centre. That's most people from the West Country come here for any emergency, and they all I know all the way down in Wincanton, places like this, they all come up to Bristol. So that's essential to have an accident in A&E in the centre of Bristol. I don't know the full story on this, but I find it very hard to believe that would be taken away. That must remain. We've got huge hospitals all the way around. We're very fortunate in Bristol to have that many hospitals.
Well,
Frenchy Hospital and Southmead Hospital, they all have to be, must say, they're wartime hospitals, Southmead. Something would need to be done there. I've been out there, and the preparatory work they're doing there is great. It still serves the city very, very well, and communication between the city and Southmead and Frenchy is only a couple of minutes away.
So they're talking about, potentially anyway, in this story here, closing the BRI emergency department, but they see more than 6,000 people a year, Robin.
Well, it sounds as though if this proposal goes through, that Chris and I will be marching together to defend the BRI accident and emergency unit. Yeah. It's a nonsense. Bristol is growing as a city. We've already lost one A&E. To reduce two A&Es down to one is just not sustainable. It doesn't surprise me, though, Tony, because for 10 years I've been campaigning around health issues, and I'm very, very concerned about the fact that, once again, many of these decisions are being driven for cost-cutting reasons and not based on what is necessary for patient care. You have to have at least two fully sustainable A&Es in this city. I would argue that the A&E at Frenchy should never have closed either, because if you live in South Bristol, if you live in some of the areas that Chris has mentioned, getting to Southmead is not necessarily so easy. And in fact, what you literally are doing, and it's not an exaggeration in this case, is playing with life and death.
Well, we waited a long time in South Bristol for a hospital, and we've got one now. I was there today at the swimming pool opposite, and it's a walk-in centre as well. The one we had at...
You're talking about the health park.
The health park. The Hengrove Health Park. And I must say it's a walk-in A&E there, and that provides quite a lot for the people in South Bristol. We did have the walk-in centre at the Norwest health centre, which provided, and that's now sadly closed, but it's been diverted to Hen Grove. And it looks a great building. I've been around there. It's wonderful for South Bristol.
Well, this is all tied up with this decision to merge the two trusts, which is ongoing. A final decision about whether the two trusts, that's the University of Bristol's Hospital Trust and the North Bristol Trust, should merge, is due to be made on January or February next year, and could see the new organisation being created by the end of next year. A project team is being put together to look in more detail at how an integrated organisation would work. I mean, this does seem to be UHB, the University Hospitals Bristol Trust initiative, this, following a review led by the Vice-Chancellor of the University of the West of England, Steve West. The trusts have declined to release the full report, though, citing commercial confidentiality, Robin.
Where's WikiLeaks when you need them? Let's have that full confidential report in the public domain. Let's see what the reasons are driving this proposal. And in fact, I've just noticed that they talk about a combined trust being able better placed to identify savings and operate more effectively with greater operational capacity as they seek to make an extra 17 million in savings over 5 years. We come back to it again, Tony. They want to save, but what that's a euphemism for is cutting a service that more Bristolians than ever will need. So I am 100% opposed to this, along with Chris. We'll both be marching down at the BRA if they try to close our A&E.
Well, they may be wanting to save that extra 17 million pounds over 5 years to help pay for the PFI up at Southmead. Who knows, because that's going to cost a few, Bob. We'll be talking about that after the 6 o'clock news. On to our next story. Blind human rights activist Jen Quang Cheng arrives in the US but fears for his family in China. Now, I only bring this up, this is quite an old story actually from May, because we have a situation here very similar to the Assange case. The blind Chinese activist Jen Quang Cheng arrived in May in the United States to begin a life in the US while vowing to keep fighting against injustice in his homeland, China. Now, here's somebody that actually sought asylum within the United States Embassy in China. And a little deal was done behind the scenes with Hillary Clinton and the Chinese Politburo. And he was then, they said to him, oh, okay, well, we'll just make sure you can go over to the US. So I wonder, this is going back to the Assange story here, whether maybe the similar thing can't be done with Assange. Can't they? I mean, I don't like to think of the idea of him sort of popping out of the top of the Ecuadorian embassy with a jetpack, or else, you know, maybe coming out the front door in a completely disguised with a false beard on and moustache and this kind of thing. So he's got to get out somehow.
I honestly think the coalition hasn't got a clue how to handle the Assange situation. I think they're rapidly rowing back and engaged in damage limitation today after Hague's silly remarks yesterday. Behind the scenes, there may be discussions going on. I'm not suggesting that if serious accusations have been made against Assange, then he shouldn't answer those accusations. I would want to know a lot more about the nature of those accusations and whether, in fact, those accusations are part of a bigger plot involving the US to discredit the man so that he can ultimately be brought back to the US. But this one's going to run and run.
The proof of the pudding really is, well, I think, whether the Swedish authorities, the Swedish police, can come and interview him in London. That would seem to solve the entire issue. And then they can either charge him or not charge him. Okay, on to our last story. And this is the Home Office pathologist, Freddie Patel, who made 68 mistakes in the autopsy of the guy that died at the G20 in 2009, Ian Tomlinson. Well, 68 mistakes. Well, you must be a Rupert Murdoch newspaper editor if you believe that they were all mistakes. This is a story from the Daily Mirror a couple of days ago. A pathologist faces being struck off for his 68 failings during the bungled probe into the death of Ian Tomlinson. Dr. Freddie Patel was found to be misleading, dishonest, and liable to bring the profession into disrepute over his handling of the post-mortem examination. It emerged today, and Simon Israel on Channel 4 News gave a report a couple of days ago on this, so let's have a listen to that now.
Today the GMC has made 52 findings of fact against this one Home Office pathologist to do with how he carried out that post-mortem, where he refused to admit to these things. 52 findings of fact, and among them, he failed to find the internal bleeding. He diagnosed it as a heart attack, and clearly other pathologists came along and said he is completely wrong. And worse still, he allowed crucial evidence to be poured down a plug hole. Well, he's been up before the GMC before. There have been a string of cases, notably Back in 2002, people may remember, there was an awful case called the Camden Ripper. He was called in as a pathologist. He ruled that the victim may have killed herself and delayed the proper murder investigation at that stage.
That's Simon Israel on Channel 4 News reporting on the General Medical Council. That's the GMC's looking into this chap, Freddie Patel. Chris Davis, this guy, it just beggar belief that he's able to practice still. I mean, actually, he's been suspended, but there's a possibility here that he may be allowed to continue to practice.
I wouldn't have thought so.
Can you make 68 mistakes? And it's such an important case here. The problem here being, this is the same Home Office that told us a week and a half ago that the person who was going to stand for the Labour Party for police and crime commissioner wasn't allowed to stand because of it just seemed that we can't really have a lot of confidence in a Home Office that is prepared to, up until this week anyway, employ this guy as a pathologist and also tell us that we can't have somebody who to be our police and crime commissioner because of a tiny offence, a fine of £5 when they were a teenager.
Well, this pathologist is, as you say quite rightly, he's been currently suspended, and really my view, he should be sacked, and I think that's the next stage for this Dr. Patel. That's what will happen too, I'm pretty sure of that.
I think the question also that has to be asked, and it's a sinister question, is why was Patel given the job of doing the post-mortem on Ian Tomlinson? Ian Tomlinson's death was very high profile. It was as a result of being pushed by a police officer, and Patel was brought in, presumably, to engage in a cover-up. Now, if that isn't the case, then I think the person responsible for bringing him in has to explain why he was brought in, given that alongside this particular series of disasters, he already has, as it were, a record. If you are incompetent in your job in any other field, you aren't asked to continue with it, unless you're a banker. But what we have here, therefore, is some wider questions about Freddie Patel. And it's fantastic that he has been suspended. He should never be allowed to practice again. That won't bring Ian Tomlinson back, but it may give some solace to the family and, more importantly, to other people in the future who perhaps Patel otherwise would have been misdiagnosing and given his diagnoses to them about their loved ones' deaths.
Now, can we actually have confidence in the Home Office that they've continued to employ this guy despite all these problems with him over the years? Or maybe it's because he seems to be, not able to find the real causes of death that he's been employed. I mean, that might be a cynical thing to say, but it does make me very concerned about the Home Office and their ability to make judgments when you see someone like this over the years being continued to be employed by them.
Well, I agree, Tony. I think, there are probably some people that the Home Office in the past will have used because they would regard them as a safe pair of hands. They're going to give them the result they're looking for. It discredits the Home Office. It's an indication, once again, of the way these days that government is in no way, shape or form about giving out the interests of the people, but it's all about covering up. And so back to Julian Assange, let's have more openness, let's have more of this information in the public domain. Thankfully, Patel has been found out on this occasion, but how many other cover-ups of this sort may be going on even as we speak?
Okay, finally, Bristol businesses. This is Bristol hitting the national headlines in the Daily Telegraph. Are queuing up to join a local currency scheme, the Bristol Pound, usable only with member businesses in the city in southwest England, is to launch in September, and organisers are deluged with local firms wanting to sign up. The perception of banking and money is that it's a very ruthless system. People are out for what they can get, said co-founder Kieran Munday. This is about saying yes to something new. It's tapping into a different set of values about money.
Hey, look, I love this. I think this is great because, of course, people are responding in this way because they're completely outraged by what's going on. Unfortunately, it is limited. It's not going to change things or create wealth, but it's an indication of people saying, we don't trust the banks. We don't trust the way that currencies work these days. Let's take that energy that those people are showing and broaden it out, and let's say get rid of the existing system completely.
But Chris Davis, you're a Lib Dem councillor in the city. Ben Yearsley, investment manager at Bristol-based financial services firm Hargreaves Lansdown, won't be rushing to convert his sterling. It's just a big gift voucher scheme, he says.
I don't know much about this Bristol Pound, I'm sorry to say. I wouldn't want to... I need to speak from a position of strength, and I'll pass on.
Just quickly, what do you think, though, the idea of having our own currency here?
It sounds a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? It's not as bad as the euro.
Okay.
I won't comment on that.
Okie doke. Thanks very much, Chris. That was Chris Davis you just heard there from Noel Ward, a Lib Dem councillor for the Bristol City Council. We'll be back after the news.
The community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, several members of a punk rock band in Russia have been...